Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Author John Updike, who died yesterday at age 76, wrote boldly and artfully about everything under the sun. His literary derring do ranged from racy explorations of the American bedroom to the exploits of terrorists and witches. Here he is in an interview with On Point host Tom Ashbrook in 2006.
It's our job to take these risks and to try to conjure up out of a variety of circumstances the human elements which are constant.
If there was a constant for Updike, it was writing. Books galore, 60-something in total, and 862 stories, poems, and essays for The New Yorker magazine alone. What a career. This hour On Point, John Updike, in memoriam. You can join our conversation. What's your favorite Updike novel, story, poem? What will you remember most about this American man of letters? Joining me now in the studio is the novelist Sue Miller. She's the author of 8 books, including The Good Mother. Her most recent, The Senator's Wife, is just out in paperback. Sue, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much. It's nice to be here.
And joining me from Amherst, Massachusetts, is William Pritchard, a distinguished literary critic and professor of English at Amherst College. He's one of the great Updike scholars and had a long-running correspondence with him. He's the author of Updike, America's Man of Letters. William Pritchard, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jane.
Let's get started first here by listening to a little more of John Updike himself. At age 73, Updike talked about the challenge to come up with new material. Here he is speaking on Point in December 2005.
When I began to write 50 years ago, I thought nobody had ever quite described the things that I knew and that I saw. And so I was, in a way, news, my slant on the society, the kind of characters I could conjure up. And if you've written more or less steadily for 50 years, everything you begin reminds you of something you've already written. So it's a little hard to find that opening, that clearing in the woods that makes you feel creative and like you do have something more in you.
Professor Pritchard, you hear John Updike describing the arc of his career there. How would you describe or characterize his evolution?
Well, he was certainly a great revisitor of his material, as he suggests there. And the most recent novel, The Widows of Eastwick, of course, is a sequel to The Witches of Eastwick, and he returned in 10-year intervals to resuscitate Rabbit once more. And even after he died, some members of the family remained to talk about him. So that's part of it, the sense that the oeuvre is so large and so various that it kept giving him, impulses and ideas for new explorations. Mm-hmm.
Sue Miller, John Updike was a chronicler of suburbia in America. What insights do you think he gave us about that place in America?
Well, I think his focus in the suburban stories, or I actually think of them as being these sort of more small towns, and there were some that were very suburban, but then sort of these small New England towns, in effect, which are a little different from what we think of, I think, as suburbia. But to me, those were the domestic stories. And for me, they're the most compelling, actually. And it seems to me that the prose in them is the most moving and the most powerful of all. But I think what he gives in those stories is just a sense of the difficulty of intimacy, the strains of marriage, the wish to escape from it, and then the strong ties within it, the pain of it, the simultaneously the pain of it, and then the small pleasures of it, which he recorded with enormous care and affection. Mm-hmm. I think the affection more there than in any of his other work, I would say.
Professor, he once wrote, "When I write, I aim in my mind not toward New York, but toward a vague spot a little to the east of Kansas." Did he succeed?
East of Kansas. Well, I'm not sure I can place that exactly, but he sure succeeded as far as the Pennsylvania farmhouse and the small town of Shillington, which he called Allinger. Which, as Sue says, is so present in those great early stories, especially the ones from Pigeon Feathers. Mm-hmm. That's the place I'd suggest anybody might begin reading Updike with the title story and some of the other ones of a boy growing up and then leaving the town and then revisiting his parents and grandparents when he's a married man in Massachusetts. Whether he hit Kansas or not, he certainly hit the Eastern Seaboard, and as you know, a number of other more exotic places. He went to Brazil and he went to China and he went every place.
That's right. That's right. Let's listen to more of John Updike himself. Here he is talking with Tom Ashbrook in June 2006 about his book Terrorists. Updike's book tries to get into the mind of a young terrorist in America.
Did you worry at all about an element of presumption in coming into a religion's holy scripture, into the mind of an Arab American young man, and you know, bringing your interpretation? I mean, what are the risks? Is it a minefield or not? As you look at it as a novelist,
it's possible to do it badly, and of course it's presumptuous. But then a writer of fiction is presumptuous. You write about women from their point of view. You write about Jews and you're not a Jew. You write about foreigners. I've done this. I've even written about Muslims before with some enthusiasm in a book called The Coup. Hmm.
Sue Miller, you hear John Updike, well, using the words presumptuous and women in the same sentence. What's your take?
I think, you know, he had famously had difficulty with a sort of the part of the critical world which was concerned with feminism. And I think he suffers some from that in terms of being the generation that he's from. Just I think his notion of what women want, if you wish, is different from the notion that the people who critiqued him and who criticized him for his take on women had. I myself had a very complicated relationship to him in a certain way. I mean, he was a terribly important writer for me. I owe him a great debt. He wrote, as he said in one of the earlier interviews that you were excerpting, he wrote about the domestic, with a kind of loving attentiveness that nobody was doing at the time when I was a young woman reading. Hmm. You know, there was Bellow, there was Mailer, there was Roth, there was Cheever, who wrote about the domestic, but with this humorous, ironic touch. Mm-hmm. Updike wrote about it with this great sense of love, and you know, you could see the visual artist in his descriptions. I mean, there are scenes from his books that I feel I was present at. I can see them so vividly, and his recording of them was so tender and so incredibly clear.
But he did have his critics. I mean, what was his strategy for responding, especially to his female critics?
Well, I think he several times, by writing about women, tried to disarm them, only to have them take up arms even more fiercely against him. And I think he was perplexed by that in a certain way. I mean, I think he was a person who was very loving towards women in a way that women found offensive in some cases and difficult.
Professor Pritchett?
Yes, I was thinking of his novel S, which he spoke of as a Valentine to women.
And really made them mad.
It really made them mad, yeah, because it was satirical and comical about this woman leaving her marriage and going to an ashram and getting taken in by the guru and so on.
He did say, I was listening to some interviews with him on the internet this morning, and he did say at one point, talking about one of the books, I think it was The Witches of Eastwick, that he found women sort of, there was a series of adjectives he used, but menacing was among them. And I think that there, one senses that. And he speaks of his great affection and of his, you know, his being such an admirer of his mother's. Of course, I think he had certain ambivalence about her. But I think that the notion of women as slightly menacing is present in a lot of his work, too.
I think he's like Bernard Shaw. He can't, you know, he can't get along without them, and sometimes he can't get along with them. And Shaw's plays are filled with very interesting women about whom the men have very complicated attitudes. Mm-hmm. Lively.
In the course of John Updike's 50 years as an author, he won almost every literary prize, including Pulitzer's, two National Book Awards, but he never won a Nobel Prize. And it became somewhat of a running joke, didn't it? Did he deserve it, Professor Pritchett?
Well, I just, I, I don't know what to say about the Nobel Prize, except that they usually give it to people that I don't know about or have never heard of, and I just assume that any good, complicated American novelist, well, Toni Morrison got it. But I never thought that Updike would. After all, Robert Frost didn't either, so it's a good thing not to get, I think.
How did that get into the politics of literature and how he played into that, Sue?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Just the politics of literature and how maybe he wrote for... He had his critics, certainly, and there were many who suggested that he had a lack of substance because his style was so distinctive.
Oh, well, I think that's a... His style was so distinctive, but I think that's a canard, really. It seems to me that what maybe might have worked against him, in spite of the fact that he wrote these numerous books set in foreign countries and concerned himself with issues, sort of larger issues, but I think people saw his strength as I might be wrong. Bill, you can scold me if I am. But they saw his strength and the core of his writing as being domestic. Even his concerns in these exotic places seems largely domestic. See, it's always in close-up in a certain sense. And I think that may have worked against him, this sense of being presented with America, the domestic life of America so clearly and passionately.
Oh, he was also the cleverest man in the world, the cleverest writer in the world. And as soon as you say that, then you say, too clever by half, or someone says that, and pulls back and is put off and worried about the humor and the satire. And there's so much of that, and that's not been enough appreciated, I think.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're remembering author John Updike this hour. He died yesterday at age 76. We're joined this hour in studio by Sue Miller, novelist and author of The Senator's Wife, just out in paperback, and by Professor William Pritchard, professor at Amherst College and author of Updike, America's Man of Letters. Let's listen to a little more of the man himself. Here he is in an interview on Point with Tom Ashbrook, December 2005, John Updike responding to a caller who asked if he, as a writer, tried to paint scenes as an artist might. The interview was about his book of essays of art criticism, Still Looking, Essays on American Art.
In this age, we're seeing certainly the first sense, the one that we cater to, the one that was catered to all around us. And I do write sometimes with an attempt to... First, I have to see it myself, yes, in my head, which isn't always easy. Mm. But once I do, I try to make it visible to the reader as well. And I try not to be too fussy about style. I really just look for those words that will conjure up an image or move the thing along, because... Prose is not like painting in that painting can be appreciated at a glance, whereas prose, like music, has to happen in time, and you want to keep it moving at your own pace, but moving nevertheless.
Professor Pritchard, let's talk about Updike's style. How would you characterize it?
He said you got to keep it moving, and one of the great, maybe the best thing about his style and the hardest thing to talk about is the way it moves and the way one sentence leads to the next, the pitch and the tone of it. Frost called it ear reading. You've got to ear read Updike. You've got to read aloud, and it's wonderful for a teacher, as I'm at the moment about to deal with some of the early stories, to have the chance to read it aloud and then and reread it and try a sentence this way and that way. But I think that you know, more even than his great talent for imagery and vividness of presentation, is that matter of ear, of pace, and of absolutely unerring power.
Sue Miller, you agree?
Yes. Yeah. I think, you know, that there every now and then I would find a metaphor that stopped me, but for the most part they're sometimes very complex metaphors, and because they so directly clarify whatever it is that he's describing, the complexity, you just enter it without noticing it, in fact. And I think that's a great, great gift that he had. And he seems to be saying in the interview that it wasn't one ever that he was sort of consciously striving after, that these things just came to him. I remember a quote from him, and maybe Bill knows where this was from, but where he said that at some point, you know, you stop thinking about how you're going to take your shot, and you just go up to the hoop and just put it in. And I think that's sort of what he's saying in that interview, too, that you, if you're too self-conscious, you can't make the shot, actually. So,
would you read some?
I would. I have a passage from the Maple Stories, which is a series of stories that he wrote concerning the sort of slow and painful dissolution of a marriage. And this is from the very end of the marriage in the courtroom. He made his what now face at her. She made her beats me face back. Oh, yes, oh, yes, a disembodied voice chanted, and the judge hurried in, smiling, his robe swinging. He was a little sharp-featured man with a polished pink face. His face declared that he was altogether good and would never die. He stood and nodded at them. He seated himself. The lawyers went forward to confer in whispers. Richard inertly gravitated towards Joan, the only animate object in the room that did not repel him. "It's a Daumier," she whispered, of the tableau being enacted before them. The lawyers parted, the judge beckoned. He was so clean, his smile squeaked. He showed Richard a piece of paper. It was the affidavit. "Is this your signature?" he asked him. "It is," Richard said. "And do you believe, as this paper states, that your marriage has suffered an irretrievable breakdown?" "I do." The judge turned his face toward Joan. His voice softened a notch. "Is this your signature?" "It is." Her voice was a healing spray, full of tiny rainbows in the corner of his eye. "And do you believe that your marriage has suffered an irretrievable breakdown?" A pause. She did not believe that, Richard knew. She said, "I do." The judge smiled and wished them both good luck. The lawyer sagged with relief in a torrent of merry legal chit-chat, speculations about the future of no fault, reminiscences of the good old days of Alabama quickies excluded Joan and Richard. Obsolete at their own ceremony, Joan and Richard stepped back from the bench in unison and stood side by side, uncertain of how to turn, until Richard at last remembered what to do. He kissed her.
Great passage. Mm-hmm. Here come the Maples. And it all happened in Central Square, Cambridge, at City Hall.
Sue Miller, how did Updike's use of language, his style, how did that influence yours as a novelist?
My style is not remotely like his, so I can't claim that the style itself influenced me, except for, I think, the focus on the visual, which I think I share with him. I mean, most fiction writers do, but it seems to me, you know, there was a sort of almost Vermeer-like quality to his descriptions of the domestic, that, you know, very intense description that sort of conveys something of the mystery that's contained in everyday life. And I aspire to it, let me just say that. So,
let me bring some callers into this conversation. Now, Mike's been waiting on the line. He's in Sutton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Very good show. One of my points is that I first got to start reading Updike through my English classes in college. It was basically English 101 in how to study and how to put a story together. And he was just marvelous. He was the only person that I've been able to find who really put middle class America on a page in which you could feel the emotions of the characters.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And you hear that over and over, don't you? Again, Professor Pritchett.
Indeed, you do. And I'm glad to hear that the sense that a student could be helped and could feel that something was done here that he hadn't seen done before, she hadn't seen done before. And that's been my experience with more than one student.
You know, in my research for this program, I read an old Time magazine interview that John Updike did where he talked about this inspiration that we just were referring to. It came to him frequently, but he said writing was not easy for him. He said that you'd rather do almost anything than tackle that empty page, because what you do on that page is you. Sue Miller, how did he view his own work? Professor Pritchett, perhaps I should ask you, since you had such interesting interactions with him.
You're asking me exactly what?
How did he view his own work?
How did he view his own work? Oh, I think he demurred. He said, "Oh, it's very difficult, and I hate to go upstairs. I'd rather sit down and have another cup of coffee and read the paper." But I think there was no alternative, and this is the most amazing career of steady work, day by day by day, and weekends too. I've heard rumors that he had different rooms for different activities. So he might go in there to type a review, or go in there to write a novel in pencil, or go into another closet for a poem or two. I don't know, but it was a steady work. Irving Howe's phrase is an understatement. Hmm.
Janet is on the line now from Ipswich, Massachusetts. Hi, Janet. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share a memory I have of John Updike. About 20 years ago, I was in college at Gordon College on the North Shore and taking my first creative writing class, and wrote my first short story. And with all the hubris of a 19-year-old, I mailed it to John Updike. Didn't have his actual address, but I knew he lived nearby in Beverly Farms. And within a week, I got the most lovely typed note back from him, saying that he had enjoyed the story with a brief critique and encouraging me to continue writing and predicting that I would go far if I kept it up. And it was just amazing to me that this, you know, literary giant would take the time out to respond to somebody.
What a lovely story.
To him.
Did you keep writing, Janet?
I did. Yeah, I can't say that his prediction came true, but I was greatly encouraged by it. Very generous of him.
That's a wonderful story. Thanks for calling.
Can I add something to that?
Yes, please, Professor.
I've sent him twice on two different occasions terrific papers by a student on one of his stories, or a collection of stories, the Maple stories, in fact. And unfailingly, he, of course, responded, and he wrote back to one of them. He said, "Very good. I couldn't have done better myself."
To another call now. Mark is in Wyham, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
A sad day yesterday for me and for lots of my friends, those of us who, along with Janet, loved Updike's writing. And Wenham is actually, as the last caller, Janet, said, right next to Beverly Farms, Pride's Crossing, where Updike lived. So I went to the same college as she went to, and I used to been to John Updike at Beverly Farms at the pizza store, at the post office on occasion. We would sort of exchange neighborly pleasantries. I was a huge fan, but I didn't want to, you know, there are Nicholson Bakers out there, I suppose. He's the guy who wrote the book You and I. His understanding and knowledge of Updike's prose is just huge. And I didn't quite want to become another Nicholson Baker in that way, but I did occasionally feel like I wanted to ask him some questions about his work. And my first interaction with him was on the road between Beverly and Salem. At the time, there was a drawbridge, and I used to hate waiting for that bridge to open, but I realized that I'd seen Updike drive by in the car ahead of me. There he was, and I thought, here's my chance to ask him about this short story. It's actually not even a short story. I suppose Professor Pritchard and Sue Miller may know that piece. It's called Archangel, and it's out of Pigeon Feathers, and it's a bizarre little piece where it's an angel may be speaking. I'm not quite sure. And I had an argument with some of my professors about it. So I thought, here we are, stuck at this bridge, doing nothing. I'm going to jump out of the car and see if he'll talk to me about it.
Good for you. And did you?
I tapped on his window and said enough things to make him realize I wasn't insane or, you know, ready to try to rob him. And he put his window down, and I asked him about that story, told him my view of it, and I said, "Look, I'm in an argument. Am I right about this?" And he said, "You know, I really like what you've said about it." And I said, "Fantastic! I'll have one up on my professors. Can you just steer me a little better in your own words here?" And he said, "No, I like your words. Use your words." So, always civil, always receptive, and always eloquent. Just really, really sad to have lost him, didn't know he was sick, and so we're grieving here on the North Shore.
Mark, thank you. It's a wonderful call. Professor Pritchard, sound familiar to you?
Certainly does. And I heard David Rebnick say this morning that, speaking about the New Yorker, the word was bereft. He said they felt bereft. And thinking about John Updike's 50 years, staying with he showed up. Somebody said once about Archibald MacLeish, he showed up. Well, Updike showed up, too, and showed up in so many different ways and fields and genres. And amazing.
John Updike received, obviously, some of his greatest acclaim from the Rabbit series, a quartet of novels published over, about a 40-year span, published in 29 languages, featuring this ex-high school basketball star, Harry Rabbit Angstrom. What was the magic of that series, Sue Miller?
I think Bill should talk about it. I didn't find that as magical as others did.
Why not?
I thought it was... I loved the first one, but I felt as though the wish to have Rabbit basically experience every aspect of shifts in American culture as it went through, I lost Rabbit in it somehow. Mm. I know that others have said that, but I know that others also feel that it's his great work. And I feel it's incredibly ambitious and, of course, sustained over essentially 40 years of writing. But for me, that character in the very first story seems to... I cannot make the connection, nor with the wife, Janice. Mm.
Professor Pritchard?
I think that later on in the last two books, Rabbit is Rich and Rabbit at Rest, which I think are the culmination. I think the greatest of the four, and Rabbit at Rest, the very best. That Rabbit less and less is a character distinct from Updike, but rather often used as a vehicle for Updike's clever and interesting and thoughtful and sardonic presentation about Rabbit watches television and sees ads for piles or hemorrhoids and so on and makes reflections that you can imagine Updike making. Mm-hmm. But putting in the mouth of this hero, I don't have a problem with that, and I like the increased relaxation and humor and inventiveness of this character as he ages and eventually meets his end. Mm.
Let's squeeze in another call here before we go to break. Patricia is in Newark, Vermont. Patricia, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to chime in because John Updike is my favorite author of all time. So, of course, I'm heartbroken along with others today. And I was introduced to John Updike by my dad, who is a professor of English in Vermont at Norwich University. And now I'm an instructor at the community college here and do everything I can to get Updike into every class I teach. And I have a book of his short stories. The cover is gone. I bring it to the beach every summer and reread these short stories over and over and over again. And I think one of my favorite things that he did was the poem to an ex-basketball player. And so I just wanted to join the community of people who are feeling so sad today and who have appreciated him so much. Mm.
Patricia, thank you. Professor Pritchard, before we go to break, will you describe the letters that you exchanged with John Updike? I know for many years you had quite a correspondence.
Well, he was so good, so punctual, so responsive to, I'd send him something that I wrote. He didn't need to send me anything he wrote because I saw it in the New Yorker. But unfailingly courteous, humorous, critical. He called me his gentlest critic, and I always thought that might have a bit of a twist in it. Maybe I was too soft-headed, too ready to praise. But there was always waiting for that response was one of the delights that I've experienced over the years. When I first wrote him, I'd given a talk about nostalgia, and he wrote back a full account of his relation to nostalgia and what he thought about how that entered into his life as a writer and so on.
Sue Miller, do you have a favorite Updike work?
I think, I like the short stories very much. I mean, I think the Maple stories are for me sort of central in his work. And I like the early work, the Pigeon Feathers. I was terribly interested in his autobiography, too. I mean, it seems to me it's so interesting. His presentation of himself is so sort of scandalously honest. Mm. And so it's such a complex contrast to the courtliness that we're talking about.
Let's pick
here.
That up after the break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. More to come. This is On Point. We're remembering author John Updike this hour. He died yesterday at the age of 76. We're joined this hour by Sue Miller, novelist and author of The Senator's Wife, just out in paperback, and by William Pritchard, professor at Amherst College and author of Updike, America's Man of Letters. I'd like to hear more now from John Updike himself. Tom Ashbrook spoke to John Updike in December 2005 about his book of essays of art criticism, Still Looking, Essays on American Art. Here, Updike talked about the feelings of kinship he had with American painter Edward Hopper.
The 30s scenes, 30s, 40s scenes he painted were the scenes of my childhood, and they speak to me just on the level of nostalgia. But beyond that, he dealt with the ordinary, and I would like to deal with the ordinary. The heroes in his paintings are every man and woman, and he captured the a certain melancholy that goes with American existence.
Professor Pritchard, how did John Updike feel about America? Did he consider himself an artist or a poet of sorts of democracy?
There's a nice passage in his memoir, his early memoir, called The Dogwood Tree, A Boyhood. And in it, he talks about what he calls the three great things. And he says they're sex and religion and art. And the third is art. And he has the following sentences about himself as a young, as a hopeful cartoonist. He was a very fine cartoonist and went to Harvard and cartooned for the Lampoon, wrote poems that he called cartooning in verse. But he said he saw art, this young man, he saw art between drawing and writing, he ignorantly made no distinction, as a method of writing a thin pencil line out of Shillington, that's his hometown, out of time altogether into an infinity of unseen and even unborn hearts. He pictured this infinity as radiant. How innocent! But his assumption here, like his assumptions on religion and politics, is one for which I have found no certain substitute. That seems to me to say a lot about continuity and about childhood and age and how you hang on to your beliefs.
Hmm. Read for us the poem, the John Updike poem, Professor Pritchard, that you have chosen for today in honor.
Well, this is an unrhymed sonnet, and it was written rather late in his life. He wrote, he never cared too much about form. He could be very formal and clever and rhyming in the light verse, but when he was serious, he loosened up, and he didn't. Anyway, this is called Perfection Wasted. And another regrettable thing about death is the ceasing of your own brand of magic, which took a whole life to develop and market. The quips, the witticisms, the slant adjusted to a few, those loved ones nearest the lip of the stage, and their soft faces blanched in the footlight glow, their laughter close to tears, their tears confused with their diamond earrings, their warm pooled breath in and out with your heartbeat. Their response and your performance twinned. The jokes over the phone, the memories packed in the rapid access file, the whole act, who will do it again? That's it, no one. Imitators and descendants aren't the same. Hmm. That's perfection wasted.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phone. San Diego is where Jonathan is. Welcome to the program, Jonathan. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks. I had a question. I've never heard of John Updike until today, and I'm very interested into reading his works. So my question was, number one, what good starting book I should read and how I should be able to read him. How do I read it properly so that I can get the fullness of his words?
It's a good, honest call, Jonathan. Thank you.
The fullness of his work is not is not easily accessible because there really are just so many books. And I think, you know, Bill's suggestion to start with Pigeon Feathers is just a fine one, to start with the sort of early work, the work which sort of presents the sensibility with which he'll write all the other work, essentially, and gives you a sense of his personal history, where he comes from, his feelings about the people who raised him and the life that he lived as a young person.
Yeah.
I think they're very readable also, very readable. And just and then I would think Rabbit Run would be another book to certainly sort of look at. Maybe couples for later.
All he has to do is relax and not worry about whether he's reading it right.
Exactly.
Just get into it.
Tim is calling now from Queenston, Canada. Tim, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
I was wondering if Professor Pritchard ever played golf with John Updike. He is one of the best golf writers I've ever read. He's wonderful stuff. Maybe the previous caller should take a look at Golf Dreams, a collection of his golf writings. My father and I disagreed on a whole bunch of things, but the one thing we could agree on was that Updike was a fabulous golf writer.
Hmm.
And I wondered if your guests could comment on that.
Tim, thank you. Professor Pritchard?
I quite agree, and I couldn't possibly play golf with Updike because I can't play golf. I'm no good at it. But, yeah, he's terrific. Hmm. Terrific on golf.
Here's another call from Medford, Massachusetts. Quentin is on the line. Quentin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In response to the last caller, I tried to play golf with Updike once and didn't manage to do so. But like Professor Pritchard, I had a correspondence with him for some years, and like a number of the other callers, he was very generous with his responses. I just wanted to maybe expand the discussion about Updike as a domestic or regional writer. I wrote my dissertation on Updike in the context of the Cold War, so I've got a deep vested interest in this. But in 1968, in an interview, in response to an interviewer's question, he rather defensively claims that all of his books are really about history. In fact, he has this quotation, "My fiction about the daily doings of ordinary people has more history in it than history books." So that interested me. And then beyond that, I think what might be important to remember is that a number of his works weren't either regional or domestic, and Sue Miller mentioned this before too, as did Professor Pritchard, but works like The Coup, a 1978 novel which takes place in Africa, is very interesting and expansive kind of vision of America within a global context, as well as the earlier work, Beck, which we haven't really talked much about Beck yet today, but Beck's stories in the Soviet Union are worth considering. And then later in life, Brazil, and even his final work, The Widows of Eastwick, has a number of different settings in it that are not America. So I think it's important to think about Updike that way, too. And, of course, this was present in a number of his reviews as well of foreign writers, not just American writers.
Quentin, thanks for your call. Professor Pritchard, your response?
I just heard him say that in a recent interview, I think last fall, that he was getting started on a new novel, working, finding it difficult, and it was going to be set in the year AD 1. So that's an indication of the extravagance and the difficulty that he was willing to take on.
Speaking of expanding out beyond small town America, here's John Updike talking with Tom Ashbrook in June 2006 about his book Terrorist.
Did you take this project on as a matter of personal curiosity or public service or both? What's the mission here?
Writers, insofar as they perform a public service, try to, expand your sympathies and lead the reader's sympathies into places where they wouldn't ordinarily go. I thought a terrorist would be a good place for Americans to try to see from within. And it interested me personally. I find myself more than normally interested in the phenomenon of suicide bombers, and even in a kind of death wish that seems to run through teenagers when no Islamic ideology is in question. I mean, the Columbine-type massacres, which are, one was perpetrated with horrendous results and many seem to be contemplated, and the costumes, the sort of death-courting outfits that kids wear now. All this is fairly new to me. It certainly wasn't in Chillington High back in the 1940s.
Sue Miller, what do you make of Updike's philosophy that you hear there of exploration, of extending sympathy?
Well, it seems to me that he's sort of quintessentially does that. I mean, he is not an ironist. He doesn't wish to sort of maintain a distance from his characters. He enters them. I mean, it's sort of the Flaubert, Madame Bovary, same way. I mean, I think he really tried to imagine the way the world felt for each of the characters that he wrote about, tried to genuinely sort of see through the eyes of those characters. And I think that's one of his greatest gifts, is actually this sort of lack of distance between himself and whoever it is that he's trying to imagine, which makes one think he could have imagined the one AD perfectly well, too.
Professor Pritchett, John Updike was also a devout Christian. How did that inform his writing?
Well, it was there. I remember one interview. The interviewer asked him, "Are you religious?" And he answered it by saying, "Yes, I try to be," and so on. I try to be. I was interested in that. But it comes into the work most strongly in the first Rabbit novel, in Rabbit Run, which is full of angstrom, and shows that he'd been reading, Updike had been reading his Kierkegaard and his Barthes, and it's a real crisis that the hero has in that novel.
But it seems that he felt that there was something sort of redemptive about, you know, describing God's creations, even its seediest, ugliest corners. I mean, what seemed to be the way that he linked theology and writing?
Well, he said that we were put on earth, I think he says someplace, we were put on earth to praise creation. And he saw his task, his overall task as a writer, to be alert in that praise. And creation contains all kinds of unlovely things that the novelist can turn his attention to.
Back to another call now. Richard is in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the program. I appreciate you waiting.
Thank you. I have something of a bothersome criticism of his writing, actually. The melodic line of his sentences is so beautiful in the way they culminate and lead into the next. He turns out such gems of paragraphs that the thing that bothered me is that I would have to pause and say, how wonderful that is. I must read it again. And every few pages, my reading would be interrupted by this phenomenon. And I think that was the only thing that I found wrong with his writing, although later on I think he became a bit more convoluted in his style, and I had to become a sort of a detective for the original pronoun. But luckily that didn't last too long. But I think his writing was such perfection. It was like poetry, and prose or poetry, I sometimes didn't know the difference because it was such perfection and structure of his paragraphs.
Richard, thank you.
Yeah, I think that, as I said earlier, I think that he, for the most part, the kind of intricacy that he was capable of was in the service of seeing things and of being present, of making the reader be present. But that occasionally, yeah, you sort of stumble on it. It's just so striking or arresting, or in fact, sometimes simply the use of words that were so sort of unknown to me. I mean, just the need for a dictionary, which is not a bad thing.
Let's squeeze a couple more calls in here. Jeff is from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Today's a snow day. I'm a school teacher, so I'm just here at home working and listening to you guys. And I knew John Updike was sick, but I didn't realize he died so suddenly. But I wanted to just share that John Updike, his Rabbit Run book, was the first book that I read the book in sophomore year of high school, and I wrote my first term paper ever on him. And I'm 37, but thinking about what he meant back then to me, I sort of have to think about his main character and the attempts to escape the constraints of life. And I look back now and I think, you know, this is where I was at, I think, when I was in high school. But I've never forgotten his writing and the impact it had on my life.
And I'm reading here that you still have the term paper that you wrote on Rabbit Run 20 years ago.
I do. I still have it, and it's something that's always stayed with me. So even though I teach math now, I've never forgotten my background in ELA and English language arts and stuff, but I'm very proud of the impact he's had on my life.
Jeff, thank you. Terry is on the line from Winchester. Terry, welcome to the program. Our time is short. If you could squeeze in your comment, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, sure. I'll be fast.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that I first read Rabbit Run when I was like 12 years old, and I thought, man, is this what it's about? But I thought there was an innocence also to the world as he described it. He was just like that little kid on his front porch, watching things, writing them down, telling what he saw, which is, I think, all God ever wanted us to do. I think when 30 years later, when I read Self-Consciousness and I saw him evoke that childhood that he had, I tucked it under my arm and I was walking into downtown Boston and I crossed the street and a letter carrier was coming the other way. And he said to me, I read that book. He said, that guy can even make psoriasis interesting. So I thought that was a great ringing endorsement.
Terry, thank you. There's a familiar theme that's running through this hour, Sue Miller. John Updike's, obviously, his brilliance, but also his unfailing graciousness. And I have a story, you have a story that I wish you'd tell about meeting him at Fenway.
Yeah, there was a Penn New England ran a sort of benefit at Fenway Park and invited a number of writers. And I was to sort of be his escort, as it were, to make sure everything was easy for him and he had whatever he needed at the time. And his just his graciousness was something that he was gracious to the other writers present, who were Roger Angel and Doris Kearns Goodwin, and gracious to every single person who came up to him and asked him to sign the piece that he'd written on Ted Williams, which was part of the reason he was there. And I think that when we're talking about him in this way, his writing, but then also I think the persona. I mean, he wrote a lot about himself. His fiction itself reveals a lot about himself. Mm-hmm. And then he was this person who, in a way, was almost stylized in his courtesy and his mm-hmm. graciousness to others. And that was it just is it's a very fascinating mix because of the sort of brutal honesty in a certain way in both his fiction and in his nonfiction about himself. Mm.
Professor Pritchard, I'll give you the last word. Your thoughts today?
Well, just that he was so generous and so imaginatively outgoing that he even created heroes who were worse than he was. That this equable, generous, courteous person could turn in the fiction into, as he does in Toward the End of Time, a kind of monster. And that seemed to me says something about the disinterested notion of aesthetic criticism and aesthetic response.
Thank you so much to my guest today, Professor William Pritchard, joining us from Amherst, Massachusetts, professor of English at Amherst College, longtime literary acquaintance of John Updike's. He's the author of John Updike, America's Man of Letters. How nice to have you on, Professor. Thank you for your perspectives.
Thank you very much.
And Sue Miller in the studio with us here in Boston, author of 8 novels, the most recent, The Senator's Wife, which is just out in paperback. Sue, terrific to have you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.